If you've ever taken in a day game at Camden Yards, perhaps in the right field seats in the shadow of the B&O warehouse, or walked through Petco Park's historic Western Metal Supply Building on the way to your seats along the third baseline to watch the Padres play, or caught a home run ball from your perch on top of the Green Monster at Fenway Park, then you have Larry Lucchino to thank. The idea of Camden Yards came from the fertile mind of Larry Lucchino, who from 1988 to 1993 was the president of the Baltimore Orioles. When Bob Costas joined me in season 3 of this podcast, he noted that Camden Yards started a ballpark design revolution that can be seen in ballparks throughout the country today,
which are tremendously appealing. And when you think about the ballpark, I forget what it's called now, but the ballpark in Chicago where the White Sox play, that was built in the early 90s. And it was the last one built before it dawned on everybody that we got to go back to the future here, that baseball has a unique kind of appeal, a unique kind of connection to its fans, and ballparks, the venues, are part of that connection.
And it all began with the opening of Camden Yards in April of 1992.
From the small town sandlots to the emerald patches in the nation's great cities, baseball fields are special places. Each one is the setting and the stage for an American rite of passage. And each is part of the fabric and fiber and mythology of the nation. The greatest of these green fields are hallowed places, pieces of Americana that live on in the minds of those who experience them. Forbes Field, Wrigley Field, Ebbets Field, Fenway Park. These are baseball's forefathers. And in 1992, their descendant, Oriole Park at Camden Yards, baseball's newest tribute to the game and its traditional, old-fashioned values, opened its gates.
After his time in Baltimore, in 1995, Lucchino joined the San Diego Padres as president and CEO and was responsible for bringing Petco Park to life.
It's not just about baseball. It's about generations of people who took their kids to ball games, Padre ball games at Lane Field, and they took their children to San Diego Stadium, Jack Murphy Stadium, Qualcomm, and now here today at Petco Park.
Petco, which so beautifully reflects the city of San Diego, was recently named Best Ballpark in America. In 2002, Lucchino was appointed president and CEO of the Boston Red Sox. In addition to helping bring that franchise its first championship since 1918, he was also tasked with renovating the hallowed grounds of Fenway Park. I'll never forget watching the first game with fans on top of the Green Monster.
Well, welcome to our vantage point here tonight, up here in the Monster seats. This is a little different view for us here.
Yeah, this is nice. I like this.
I interviewed Larry several months ago and had planned on releasing the episode later this year. But in light of his recent passing and for all the good that he did for the game of baseball, we present this episode to you now. May it serve as a tribute to the memory and lasting legacy of Larry Lucchino.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And this should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Go pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
Larry Lucchino, can you hear me okay?
Mike, I can hear you fine.
So I'm assuming since you were raised in Pittsburgh, you probably spent a lot of time at Forbes Field. Did you grow up going to games at Forbes Field?
I did. My brother, I had an older brother named Frank. Frank and I would go to games with some frequency. We would go in the sixth or seventh inning when they opened the gates to allow people to come to go out. We would go in and pray for extra innings.
It's time for Pirate Baseball. Hello, everyone, with Bob Prince and Nellie King. This is Gene Osborne speaking to you from Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, where we've set up our microphones to bring to you the second game of the doubleheader between the Pirates and the Cubs.
What can you tell those of us who never had the opportunity to see a game at Forbes Field? What was that old ballpark like?
Well, Forbes Field was a special place. It it captured some of the old time values about baseball, and it allowed people to fantasize about baseball. And it was a wonderful place to watch a game. It was replaced by Three Rivers Stadium, which was a concrete donut meant for both football and baseball. And it didn't work well for either, in my view.
Yeah, and I think that longtime Pirates broadcaster Bob Prince, who was the voice of the Pirates from 1948 to 1975, would definitely have agreed with that sentiment. The final game at Forbes Field was played June 28th, 1970, and you can hear Bob Prince fighting back the emotion of calling his final game there.
There must be a little sadness in one Robert Prince after all these years.
Thank you, Gene. Nelly, hello again, everybody. There's more than a little sadness. It's a tremendous, overpowering amount of grief, in a sense. It's one of the real tough things to do, because I realize this is where I received my start, from the late Rosie Rosewell. I've seen so many wonderful and great thrills, and to know now that I have approached the final, absolutely, totally final end of this ballpark, is something. It's like losing a dear loved one, not quite as bad when you expect them to pass away, and when it does happen, you still are grief-ridden.
You didn't live too far from Forbes Field, but how would you and your brother get to games?
We lived close enough that we would either walk or we would hitchhike.
Okay, wait a second. So how old would you have been when you were hitchhiking with your brother?
Oh, I don't know, 8 or 9.
Wow, what a different time, right?
Yeah.
So at Forbes Field, if you were sitting behind home plate in the upper deck, looking out towards the outfield wall, there was this beautiful, expansive view of Schenley Park, green lush landscape with towering oak trees just beyond the outfield wall.
That was the beginning of the ballpark as park. It was a concept that I've tried to live by, and they're doing various ballparks since then.
Yeah. In fact, we had ballpark architect Janet Marie Smith on the podcast last year. Janet has worked with you on many ballpark construction projects, including Camden Yards and the renovations at Fenway Park, just to name a couple. And yeah, she talked about how important it was that it was called a park, a ballpark, and not a stadium.
Larry came to fine anyone who used the S word. He wanted a ballpark, not a stadium.
And of course, the ballpark that would become the blueprint for all the ballparks that you would later create was the ballpark of your youth, Forbes Field. And there were many historic games played at that ballpark. In 1959, the city of Pittsburgh and Forbes Field welcomed baseball fans across the country for the 1959 All-Star Game.
From Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Gillette Safety Razor Company welcomes you to the 26th All-Star Baseball Game. Hello there, everybody, with Jack Brickhouse. This is Bob Prince, ready to bring you the mid-season baseball classic.
Did you go to the 1959 All-Star Game?
No, I did not, but I did attend some of the 1960 games when the club won the World Series in what was a special year for the Pirates and for Pittsburgh. And my first memory goes back to the late 50s when I was there at a game with my brother, and it did go into extra innings. And in the 11th inning, Bill Verdon threw a perfect strike from deep right center field to home plate. My eyes lit up. I was so amazed that someone could throw a baseball that accurately that far. And I had all the other memories that other people have, the looking through the vomitory and seeing the green grass. It was remarkable. And as well as the various neighborhoods of Forest Field that stayed with me for quite some time.
And wow, Larry, what a magical run in 1960 for the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Pittsburgh, famed for its steel mills and the shimmering glow of its blast furnaces. Pittsburgh, that in 1960 gained new distinction, for the Pirates won their first pennant in 33 years.
They played the New York Yankees in the World Series, and to say that they were an underdog in that World Series would be a huge understatement, but somehow they found a way. And so you're 14 or 15 at that time in 1960.
I was just beginning high school, and I was hitchhiking home, in fact, during the Mazeroski home run, listening to the game on my transistor radio.
Sudden death now, last of the night.
So you're in someone else's car?
No, actually, I was on the side of the road.
And one of the most famous moments in baseball history happens.
Here's a swing and a high fly ball going deep to left. This may do it. Back to the wall goes Vera. It is over the fence. Home run, the Pirates win.
And given the historical significance,
Forbes Field is at this moment an outdoor insane asylum. We have seen and shared in one of baseball's great moments.
I wish there would have been more done to save more of Forbes Field.
They actually go to the trouble to save a part of Forbes Field. They saved the wall where Mazeroski's home run went over, preserved it around a law school, which the University of Pittsburgh built on the site.
Have you been back to the site to walk along the wall?
Yes, I have.
I'm sure it brings back a flood of memories, huh?
It surely does.
Do you have any memorabilia in your house from Forbes Field?
Yeah, I've got some photographs. And a Ralph Kiner signed autograph baseball.
That's one of the great champs of the game. It's the last of the ninth. Yes, it's Ralph Kiner. And he can win the game for the Pirates if he can connect. Wait it out, boy. Here's the pitch. It's a hit. Going, going. It's gone. It's into the stands for a home run. That's what I mean, the spark of a champion. Wheaties man Ralph Kiner in action. He powers up with Wheaties. And what sparks a champion sparks you.
In 1971, when the demolition of Forbes Field was underway, you could pick up a Forbes Field seat for $5. The other day, I was online, and four Forbes seats were selling for $7,500.
Oh, my gracious. Yeah. Well, my house is full of chairs from ballparks. I have a couple of chairs from Camden Yards. I have a couple of chairs from Petco Park. I have a couple of chairs from Fenway Park. I have a couple of chairs from the ballpark here at Polar Park. And so I've got about eight or 10 chairs from ballparks.
For all of us who have a love of old ballparks, for places like Ebbets Field and Tiger Stadium and Forbes Field and the Polo Grounds, Comiskey Park and Crosley Field, thank you for having the vision to, as Bob Costas said in season 3 of this podcast, to take us back to the future with the creation of Oriole Park at Camden Yards and then Petco Park in San Diego, followed by what you've done with Jana Marie Smith to preserve Fenway Park. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mike. You're very welcome. It's good to have someone who appreciates that time as well as that moment in sports history. And it was distinctive and special. And certainly memorable.
What is it about ballparks back in the golden age, and more recently, the cascade of retro ballparks that leaves such an indelible mark on so many of us?
Well, I think that ballparks are something special because in theory, they're owned by each of us. And they're not a civic property as much as they are a civic property held for the constituency of the town. And we all feel a certain sense of pride in ours. And the ballpark that we're talking about, Forbes Field, was peculiarly well-suited for baseball. It was deep in right center, 457 feet. But other than that, it was peculiarly well-situated for baseball.
I'd love to talk, Larry, for just a minute about the ballparks that you helped bring to life. In 1988, you joined the Baltimore Orioles. At the time, Memorial Stadium, though beloved, had kind of run its course. And you set out with the aid of Jana Marie Smith to create an old-fashioned ballpark. That is to say that you weren't looking to just construct a new shiny thing, but something that felt like Baltimore and would become the centerpiece to revitalizing the Inner Harbor.
Well, we were looking for a traditional old-fashioned ballpark with modern amenities, that's fair to say.
Yeah.
And we were looking for something that would be special for Baltimore. And right from the beginning, I was told Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner, and others who would listen, that we wanted a different kind of ballpark. We wanted something irregular and asymmetrical and intimate and something like the old ballparks. And I said to Edward Bennett Williams, who was the owner of the team at the time, if you look at the best ballpark, best ball clubs in America, you will see something unusual. They all play in a baseball-only facility. So let's try to play in a baseball-only facility.
The late John Steadman, who was a writer for the Baltimore Sun, told you and anyone that would listen that the B&O warehouse was rat-infested and should be burned down. Thank goodness that no one listened to that advice.
Yeah, he called it a rat-infested fire trap.
Yeah.
He called it a rat-infested fire trap. And we did listen to him from time to time, but thank God we didn't listen to him there.
Yeah, and I think it's important, Larry, to provide some context for what you and your crew were up against in the creation of Camden Yards. At the time, nobody was designing anything like it. In fact, Peter Uberoth was actually working on a plan with the company to create a generic model of a ballpark so that when a team needed a new park or an expansion team began construction, they would just use ready-made plans, and eventually all ballparks would look and feel the same. Thank goodness that never happened.
Yeah, well, he was, I think it showed Peter was very good at lots of things, but he wasn't a true baseball fan. He didn't grow up with the sport the way that many of us did. And I remember that idea, and he was talking about a generic ballpark that was all the same. And he just didn't get it.
What did you borrow from the design and experience of going to games at Forbes Field that you found useful in the creation of Camden Yards?
Well, certainly the notion of a baseball first ballpark. And there was this as intimate and irregular as it could be. I remember this was a time when people were designing 325 down the line, 375 in the power alleys, and 400 in center field. And it was a similarity to them. I was more interested in creating an asymmetrical ballpark because that was part of its charm.
Though I grew up in Cleveland, Larry, my home since 1999 has been San Diego, and I'm indebted to you for creating the masterpiece that is Petco Park.
Young and old, the fans came out for opening night at Petco Park to see history in the making.
I'll probably never see the opening of another San Diego ballpark, and he probably won't either. This is a beautiful place. It'll last for a long time.
There is so much to love about Petco, from the view of the Coronado Bay Bridge that can be seen as you walk along much of the concourse, to the Western Metal Supply Building. Did that building cement the decision to build in that specific location?
I don't know that it was that central. It was certainly important to us because we had done a ballpark before in Baltimore that had a warehouse, and there was something unique about the location as a result of that warehouse. So we always wanted to preserve that warehouse. And my niece, Jennifer, who just graduated from Rice Architecture School, was charged with the responsibility of making sure that that warehouse fit into the ballpark.
It is one of my favorite elements of the experience of going to a game at Petco Park, walking in that particular entrance and then making your way through the Western Metal Supply Building and down, for instance, to your seats along the third base line. And I go to several games a year at Petco Park, and I believe, Larry, that we will, in 100 years, look at Petco Park in the same way that we look at Wrigley Field and Fenway Park today.
I think that's right. I'm glad to hear you say that, Mike, because I was just there a couple of weeks ago, and I was struck by how distinctive and beautiful it is and how much it looks and feels and tastes like San Diego. It is an outdoor facility in that the concourses are outside, and there are trees and bougainvillea everywhere. I worked for 7 years on that ballpark. It was something that we can all feel an enormous sense of pride in. Certainly San Diego does.
Yeah, well, I really think it speaks to the notion that no matter what you were involved in, whether it was Camden Yards in Baltimore or Petco Park in San Diego, the preservation and restoration of Fenway Park in Boston, JetBlue Park in Fort Myers, or Polar Park in Worcester, Mass., that you didn't set out to build something new. You set out to make something that felt like its surroundings.
That's right. I remember staying here in Worcester, on a ballpark that looks and tastes and feels like and smells like Worcester. And people used to laugh at me. But I think they're very pleased that we have a ballpark as distinctive and as Worcester-like as it is. And some of it comes from Worcester advertising on the outfield and all sorts of other things. But it does feel, I mean, ballparks should reflect the town that they are in, and they should be different in baseball as they are similar in football.
And speaking of Polar Park in Worcester, Mass., there's so much to take in if you are lucky enough to go to a game there. You've got the Worcester Wall in right field, the train that occasionally passes by beyond the outfield wall, seats that overlook the visiting bullpen, much like the home run seats in the outfield at Dodger Stadium, with clear, wide concourses, with walkability all the way around the ballpark. The berm in center field, which is the grassy area for families to sit and enjoy the game.
It was a famous architect. I think his name was Mies van der Rohe, who said, "God is in the details." Yeah, how right he was about ballparks. You got to talk to the constituent groups who use those various areas and make sure that the ballpark design is reflective of the use and community that it's in.
To do what you have done, Larry, to have constructed and renovated five beautiful ballparks that will stand the test of time and start a historic ballpark revolution with the creation of Camden, all that took a tenacity and an indomitable spirit that you no doubt acquired from your parents. I mean, your mom, Rose, was a member of a bowling league into her 90s, right?
But she was 94. I was talking about it today at lunch. She actually led the physical therapy classes when she was 94. She told people to stand up and sit down and when to do push-ups and when not to. And it was very interesting. She was a remarkable woman.
Well, special thanks to your mom, Rose, and your father, Dominic, for bringing you into this world and for shaping your young life. And we're on behalf of all of us who love baseball and love old ballparks and all things traditional, thank you for doing what you have done with these great ballparks.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you very much. And I'm not sure if there'll ever be a next one. I've done five, as you say, and it's probably it. But the lessons I've learned, including intimacy, irregularity, distinctiveness, town reflection, those things I hope will be the outline for ballparks in the future, and we'll continue this movement.
Again, that episode was recorded several months ago, but man, it is so good to hear his voice, the late Larry Lucchino. Our thoughts and prayers continue to be with his friends and family. I think specifically of Jana Marie Smith, who was on the podcast not that long ago, who worked with Larry for so many, many years. And I've said it before, I really hope that the Baseball Hall of Fame finds room inside for both Jana Marie Smith and Larry Lucchino for all that they've done for the game of baseball. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by John McBride, Curtis Litzenberger, Mike Dunn, Ryan Beard, Mike Lipinski, Xavier Guerra, Mandy Zavlakis, John Carter, Alex Kemp, and Kyle Schmidt. Hope you've enjoyed this special bonus episode, a tribute to the late Larry Lucchino. Looking forward to being back with you on the first Wednesday of next month for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.